Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to this edition of the War Report. Today's show has been at least 18 months in the making. If those of you who have been with me from the beginning, that very first show, I talked about something called neoliberalism. I also said that it would be something that I needed to bring those who are going to follow with me every week along till we get to a point where I thought I could then have a discussion, a conversation about neoliberalism and its importance to public education and beyond. I've been studying neoliberalism for years. And I want to tell you up front, preparing for this show was the hardest show I've ever had to prepare for thus far. Neoliberalism is a concept, an ideology, a construction, a set of practices. It's everything. But it's like gas. You can't put your hands around it. You can't. Many scholars have worked hard to try and come up with a definitive definition of what it is and isn't, and et cetera. But we all know, and I don't put myself into that scholarly class. I just happen to know about it. I think I have somewhat of a semi-expert knowledge of it. So it's hard. And I have really put it off for 18 months until now, even up to this moment, I'm still hesitating. But basically, what I'm going to try and do over the next three shows is to tell everyone about neoliberalism, what it is, why it is so, so important that we be aware of it, understand it, have some emotional engagement, reaction, and hopefully some action in response to it, positive action in response to it. I'm going to start off with an analogy of taking a funnel. Taking the open end of the funnel, the wide end of the funnel, and you start pouring stuff in it, many, many different things in it. It travels through the funnel, and it comes out the small end as one substance. That's it. The open end of the funnel is my big picture. I'm going to try and start with what I think I do best is the big picture, and then the second episode, we will narrow that down more specifically. And then the third and last episode would be what comes out of the end of the funnel. We will apply it all to public education, schools, teachers, students, teachers' union, families, communities, whole cities, and the country. And globally, pretty big order. But that's how I think I can best approach it, and I can give you the importance, a sense of the importance of this and why it is taking me so long to get to it. So let's start with, what is neoliberalism? What is neoliberal? two words. Neo, meaning new. Liberal, meaning liberty, freedom, less control by outside forces. That's what neoliberalism has generally come to mean. The new liberal state that we are in now versus the old state where we had less freedom or no freedom, and et cetera. That's a concept. And when we start to apply, well, let me go back and go where I didn't want to go, but I think I have to, a little bit about the history of both the concept, the word, the term neoliberalism, and what it basically means. When I say neoliberalism, you think capitalism. Yes, capitalism. That goes back to the 1770s or so when Adam Smith, a Scottish scholar, philosopher, came forth with a set of ideas that he believed we needed to follow. We being the public, the country that you're in, the planet that you live on, need to follow in order to reach a utopian style world, create a reality that's based upon this utopian set of ideas that he thought were the right on the money principles or ideas. In those ideas, he put forth notions that we needed, we being the public, needed less regulation. Our government needed to pull back and be less involved in our day-to-day lives. And principally, the government needed to pull back or deregulate or reduce regulations that impacted the economic activity that we each had to engage in to order to sustain ourselves. And there was some other principle, but that was pretty much what he was talking about was capitalism. We fast forward to the 1800s, and you have a guy named Karl Marx who looked at capitalism and how it had been implemented in Europe and said, this is crap, big time crap. This capitalist thing and its implementation is so destructive to the human spirit, the human activity, to collective decision making, to collective governance, and on and on. So you have two set of ideologies, and Marx, as you already know, was an economist, a super brilliant, genius-type person, and you have two things. They have one thing in common. Both were looking at the society in which they lived in at that time and saying it needed to change. And both were putting forward ideas of how and why change needed to come about. So you have these competing philosophies at work here. Fast forward into the 1900s. In America and across Europe, we have a period of great prosperity. And for some of you, you'll recognize the term the Roaring Twenties, where more millionaires are being created via the stock market, via oil discovery, petroleum industry, and you name it. and more middle class, wealthy individuals were being created. Things were going great, and it was capitalism unleashed until the late 1920s, when we had the depression of our times. During that period of the late 1920s into the 1930s, life was horrible. Think of the Grace of Wrath as being the epitome of what life was for the working class, the poor. And also think about F. Scott Fitzgerald when he talks about the Great Gatsby, when wealth was ostentatiously on display. That was the golden or the gilded period of the 1920s that crashed during the mid-1930s, and led to another economist who put forth his vision of what we needed to do, we being society, needed to do, and that is the role of government needed to change. Instead of backing off from regulation, the government should induce more regulation. Government should work to make life better for all of its citizens. And by doing that, the country would improve, life would improve, and we would be happy thereafter. Another utopian style image here. Franklin Delano Roosevelt accepted those ideas and made it part of his platform. It resonated with the populace who were suffering, and hence he was elected, and hence he started implementing what we have come to know as the New Deal. It's a new deal in town. A new sheriff is here, and we're going to right this horrible set of conditions we're in, and this is how we're going to do it. He got government. He became big government, from small government to big government. And government, he brought in Social Security. He brought in more regulations of the financial industry. He brought in labor relations board that worked to improve the conditions for labor, both physically and economically. He brought in a whole series of government programs. And in doing so, he incurred the wrath of what was left of the wealthy class to the point where individuals got together and started formulating how they could defend themselves and their wealth against government intrusions, government programs that would, quote, sort of like more equalize the social, psychological, economic conditions of the masses. During that time, during the 40s, and then, of course, World War II breaks out, and that changes everything in terms of we go on to a war economy, there are jobs galore, businesses are paying more to get people to come work for them versus working for someone else. And so you have this period where everything is working and working well, but still you have your discontents who are not into this big government sort of thing. This sets the stage for the 60s, where we have the civil rights movement, the movement for equality, then women's movement, students movement, free speech movement, etc. All under the reign of big government. This further infuriated a whole lot of people who saw their wealth being threatened, their monopoly of power being challenged, and et cetera. Another group of people during this time, we're now into the 60s, 70s, came together and wanted to challenge the role of government and wanted to reduce government. Now, let me stop at this point and say, what I've given you is a bastardized summary of over 200 plus years of people trying to figure out what was best, the best arrangement for their survival and the quality of that survival. And what we will see going forward is that this struggle between ideas, ideology, has been part and parcel of America's existence from the 1600s up to now and going forward. So now, something happens in the early 70s. Guy named, well, there are a lot of people, but I'm singling out right now, a guy named Lewis Powell. He was about to become a Supreme Court justice. And he wrote a secret memo that basically said that, listen, folks, those of us of the opulent class, we need to wake up and realize that the country has been taken over by the minorities, by women, by climate change groups, and et cetera. We need to realize this and take action. Not as individuals, but as a group that shares a common interest, a group that needs to reestablish its dominance over American society. He sent that memo to the Chamber of Commerce, president of the Chamber of Commerce. They got it, they understood it, and from that point, they started to pull together all of the powerhouses, the IBM, the Ford, the Shell, the Chevrons, you name it, businesses, to form what will become known as the Business Roundtable, whose mission was to rein in public power and reestablish the business class as the legitimate heirs to owning and running the country. You've heard me say that phrase differently a million times, going back to after the close of the Revolutionary War, the formation of the Continental Congress, and its president, temporary president, because the Congress itself was temporary, John Jay, who became the first Supreme Court justice. And every time I say this, I still get that chill. Those who own the country ought to govern the country. I go back to that period of time, but we're really talking about the contemporary scene, contemporary being the 1970s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, and now into 2015. That's sort of like the history of set a bastardized history, short history of this notion of neoliberalism. So, you say, what then is neoliberalism? I can't really give you a clean cut, clear consensus definition because there isn't any. You go to the dictionary, you go to Wikipedia, you go to textbooks, you go to books written by experts, and you will find that there's a wide-ranging set of ideas that are considered to be neoliberalism. And the one that I subscribe to is that neoliberalism is a theory of political economic practices that proposes that the well-being of humans can best be advanced by liberalizing individual entrepreneurs free from the confines of government that is characterized by privatizing property rights, free market, and free trade. Kind of broad, encompassing definition. Oh, wait a minute. There is a caller that I think this was a good point that I can take a caller. We have the caller call at the beginning of the show, and I couldn't take him, and the caller was asked to call back. And so now I will say to any and all potential callers, you can call now. I've gotten past one point that I need to get past, and that I think I can take callers at a certain time in my conversation with you today. Okay. Some provisions of that definition of neoliberalism. Let me go back and give it to you again. A theory of political economic practices that proposes that human well-being can best be advanced by liberating individual entrepreneurs' freedoms and skills within an institutionalized framework characterized by strong privatized property rights, free market, and free trade. I think almost everyone now should recognize those buzzwords of privatized property rights, free market, and free trade. This particular conception, it says that the role of the state is to create and preserve an institutional framework appropriate to such practices. In other words, the state, we need to create a state, if that state is not already there, that recognizes, embraces, and does what it should do to establish this the privatized property rights, the free market, and free trade. That's what the role of the government should be. No more, no less. And that said state has to guarantee the equality and integrity of money, legal structures, and functions required to secure property rights, again, that word property rights, and guarantee by force, if needed, the proper functioning of markets. Now, here we're beginning to get into where the rubber meets the road. Property rights is nothing more than ownership. Ownership. Think back to beginnings of this country when chattel slavery was introduced, where human beings became property, and the people who owned them had property rights and set up rights and privileges to go with their ownership of said property. That's what we're talking about. Further, if free markets don't exist in such areas as land, water, education, health care, social security, the environment, then the government must erect such by force if necessary, and I convert that by any and every means available and necessary. So now we're getting a little more into what neoliberalism really means and what's about. And they state, beyond what I just stated, the state should limit its involvement as much as possible to a bare minimum, to so to speak. Now, let's go back and try and pull together a little more meaning here. I'm talking about a vision, a worldview that says that humanity and the planet is best served by a governmental structure that recognizes, embraces, and perpetuates and preserves property rights, create and maintain a free market, economic, political, social system, and that said government should do all it can do to bring almost what I have said in the past, everyone and everything into and under this vision of the better world, where property rights are invested into everything that we do and everything that we need to live. It was my understanding of what I just said that really brought me into, I'm going to say, 7-8 years of intense studying of what we're talking about called neoliberalism. This is huge. This is a remaking of humanity and the planet. This is envisioning a new persona, to say. And I'll go more into that later, but I want to get this idea out there, and hopefully now you become aware of it, and then hopefully I can get you to understand it critically in what I'm saying. That a utopian world is one that, but, well, let me go back and do it another way. Let me go back to my sociology. In sociology and in anthropology have looked at history for thousands of years and have determined that all societies have 5 things in common. They create 5 basic universal social institutions. These institutions are family, a family unit, religion, a religious ideology, an economic ideology, a system of ideas and practices, and they create, that's governance, more or less, where we said, they create a economic system, and that these social institutions are present in all organized societies. They're basic. They're fundamental. We need them. And lastly, and for our purposes, education. We find a way to educate all of our members, new and old. 5 institutions. Also, throughout history, one or more of these institutions have risen to dominance in that that institution takes control of all the other institutions, the whole society, and governs from that institution's perspective. A good example is religion, Christianity. When Christianity was introduced and became widely known and accepted, the institution of religion became a church that was run by a clergy. The church and the clergy became supreme deciders and authority over all of its domain. Think about it. The Pope was God's representative on earth. The bishops, the priests, were God's also children who had divine authority. And so that the church ruled over the king, the monarchs. It ruled over the family, and etc. This was the reign of religion and its control. Now, moving forward, we see there are different periods where different social institutions reign dominant. The economic institution, then the political institution had its turn. We went through a period where education was considered the great equalizer, and that everyone needed to have a formal, quality education so that the country itself would benefit and individuals would benefit, and education was almost, but not quite, king for a while. Under neoliberalism, we become governed by the economic institution. And this is critical, and the state that the economic institution says it needs in order to reach its dominant potential. You heard me say over and over again, corporate state, not state corporate. And I've explained that by saying in the beginning, the state being the individual states, the government, created corporations via law and set up the procedures through which corporations would have to go to become a corporation. And then once a corporation was established, the states and the government had rules, regulations, laws, controlling and governing the corporation. State preceded corporation. Today, I say that's been inverted. It is now the corporate state, where the corporate owns the state from the presidency, both chambers of Congress, the federal courts, state mansions, chambers of legislators, down to the city, counties, down to school boards, down to dog catchers, are all now coming quickly under the auspices of the new corporate state. Now, again, that was some more history that I think we need for a foundation in order to get to what we really need to know and understand about neoliberalism. Let me summarize by telling you the rationale that underpins neoliberalism. It's the idea that the state is inferior to the individual entrepreneur or business, or now the corporation. And because the state is so inferior, it can't possibly possess enough information, knowledge, skills to second guess the market, the free market. Remember now, the market is supreme. The market is smarter than the government, and hence the government can't do what it should be doing, it needs to do to bring about this utopian world as envisioned by neoliberalism. Okay. And especially democratic governments. Democratic governments in the neoliberal tradition is the worst kind of government you can have, because it is, one, supposedly government by the people, for the people, of the people, and the people about as dumb as individually as the government, except for those people who are the entrepreneurial class. Also, democratic governments are under the influence of very powerful special interest groups, groups that are willing to inevitably distort and bias the state's intervention in whatever it intervenes in. And hence, the government is the last entity that should dominate and control the population or the society. And let me restate that again, that neoliberalism is anti-democratic governance. It suspects that the democratic elected government is not as smart, not as intelligent, not as capable of as the single individual entrepreneur or a class of entrepreneurs or a organized business, be it a sole proprietorship, a partnership, or a corporate structure. That these individuals, these entities that are market created, they know the market. They know it better than the government ever can. And they have a set of special interests themselves that they don't talk about that is superior to the set of special interests that lobbying groups such as unions, nonprofits bring to the table to try and get legislation, trying to get conditions established that will meet and satisfy their special interests. That's huge. Since I'm not looking you in the eye, I can't see your expressions. I don't know if I'm getting my point over well enough, and I need to try it again or what, but this is huge. Democratic government cannot be trusted to bring about the utopian society like business that practice free market, free trade, individual freedom, and liberty. We have a caller. I don't know if that's the same caller or not, but hello, caller.
Hello, James. This is Tom Fiala.
This is Tom Fiala, people. Tom Fiala is a professor emeritus of School of Education, major specializing in the social cultural foundations of education. He is a scholar, an expert on neoliberalism and its effect and impact on education. He also wrote the foreword to the book that we spent 3 weeks going over and reviewing on the Common Core, called The Origins of the Common Core, How the Free Market Became Public Education Policy. Welcome, Tom.
Well, it's good to be on your show. I think my wife and I also refer to me as her graduate assistant on that project. I just want to make a comment because what you're saying is absolutely right on, and I don't want to divert you from what you're saying, but maybe we can just have this comment as almost a springboard for section two, because I know you have a whole lot more to say about neoliberalism, particularly in the 1980s. But just a comment on my part. I follow Facebook and listen to the folks out there, and it seems that there's a perception, and there's still a perception held by many folks, even the Facebook crowd, that believes that the current state of education reform, now dominated by corporations and Wall Street and entrepreneur types, and of course the usual list of Gates and Broad and Coke and Walmart type billionaires, is the result of some type of a secret governmental policy action or secret governmental policy decisions. There are even those who believe that these types of billionaires and Wall Street and those other folks got their start with the Obama administration. Certainly, Obama opened up education reform to these folks to a much greater degree. However, the neoliberal assault on education and the influence of these business and Wall Street folks and the creation of a huge financial market related to reforming education began way before Obama, and I know you're going to be talking about that. And the plan to do this was not secret. For example, clearly the relationship between President Reagan and his economic guru, Milton Friedman, makes this very clear. And I only say this as maybe a springboard to some of the other things you're going to be saying, talking about the 1980s President Reagan and Margaret Thatcher and Pinochet and some of these other points. But this was not a secret action. They were working together. It was clear they were going to do that. I would argue we just simply didn't listen. We didn't look carefully at what was going on, just like we didn't look carefully at what was going on during the Bush 1 administration or Clinton administration, et cetera, et cetera. That's my only comment, and I don't want to take you off course.
Tom, you are exactly where I plan to leave off and start next week. That is the 1980s, actually 1978, 79, and then into the 1980s, and then taking it all the way to where we are today. In fact, I'm going to close out with some comments about the 1970s and a little bit more about neoliberalism. Tom, you're welcome to stay on board and or say goodbye. But anyway, let me go forward. Now,
I'll say goodbye. I'm going to continue to listen. I'll listen next week, and if I have anything that I think is positive to say next week, I'll give a call. Keep going. This is really informative, and folks need to understand what you're talking about. Good job.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Tom. I brought us up to the 50s, the 60s, and what have you. It was during the 1970s that there was a rush or stampede towards neoliberalism in politics and economics. People started, like he just mentioned, Milton Friedman, scholars, politicians, business people, everyone started thinking that the free market was the way to go. And they set in motion, as I will talk about more in detail next time, the organizational structure that was needed to push neoliberalism to the forefront, put it on the minds of everyone, to shape everyone's thinking, their emotions, and embracing neoliberalism and its concept, its principles. So we have here in the 70s a marriage of two social institutions, the political and the economic. That formed the basis of present-day neoliberalism. And from the early 70s, and I talked about Lewis Powell memo, which I will have to then come back to next year. I'll probably start with that, and how it was perceived during that period of time that the rich, the powerful, had lost control of the country. The radical students, the radical blacks, the radical women, the radical peace movement, the radical environment movement, these people were seizing control of the country. They were marginalizing the rightful owners. Those who own ought to govern. They were threatening the hell out of the status quo. And the principles of deregulation, privatization, the withdrawal of the state from any areas of social provisions, the notion of the social network. Those radical groups were pushing the government to increase all of those areas, regulation, da-da-da-da, the social network. And this is ironic. That group on the left of the political spectrum was called the liberal group. And they were destroying the country. But we also have in the word neoliberalism the word liberal, which brings me to the point that I want to sort of get to before we leave, and that is neoliberalism, neoliberal as a term, is not what it seems to be. It is not new liberalism. It is not a new set of liberal arrangements. It inverts the notion of liberal as if in, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It perverts the notion of the Constitution, First Amendment, Fourth, Fifth Amendment, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, and some other amendments of the Constitution. And it is, I guess, maybe best for me to express it as neoliberalism is a Trojan horse that has hidden inside of it a total reversal destruction of liberalism as we think it is, and redefining liberalism in different terms, different values that are consistent with this vision of the utopian society, as that utopian society is structured, built, controlled, and run by the people who own the society, must and should govern it. Now, again, that's a lot to say. I don't know how well I've done in terms of trying to get over what you need to know. I'll say this. I've been working on this for 18 months, and I'm still not confident that I have it right for you. But I also want to say that during that 18-month period of time, a couple of people got it and were very, very much into what I was saying, so much so that they've written me, they've called me, we have developed Facebook friends, we've become colleagues, and et cetera. And I want to dedicate this series to them because it was those people who kept me going and not giving up on trying to put this together in some coherent fashion. One is a young man out of Texas. Christian is his name. He is an educator. He is a former military officer who got into education. He's a graduate student working on his doctorate. He fully understands neoliberalism. He wrote me, he called me, he emailed me, he sent me stuff, and we've had plenty of talks over the months. Next is a person here in Los Angeles, Robert D. Skills. Robert, at UCLA, graduated from UCLA, started law school. He got it. And he let me know that he had gotten it, and he appreciated me trying to make the public aware of it, so much so that he wrote a blog post a few months back that he dedicated it to me. Blew me away, Robert. I told you then, I'm telling you now. And then there are the people on my team. You know Joe Lieb, and when she was here, Lucy Sanson, and Joan Kramer, who have been with me from the beginning. They got the neoliberalism and have encouraged me and pushed me to finally do the show. In fact, when we finally put it together Thursday and start promoting it, one of them said, finally, we're going to do it. So now my time is up. Part two next week. Thank you for being here and have a good Sunday, folks.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.